Chapter 12 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 12. From the day when I first met Oscar Wilde, as I have described, he made up to me in every possible way. He was continually asking me to dine or lunch with him, and sending me letters, notes, and telegrams. He flattered me, gave me presents, and made much of me in every way. He gave me copies of all his books with inscriptions in them. He wrote a sonnet to me, and gave it to me at dinner one night in a restaurant. That was after I had known him about 6 months. It is in the Methuen Complete Edition, and it begins, "The sin was mine, I did not understand." Anyone who takes the trouble to read it carefully will see that it shows clearly that the familiarities, to use Harris's word, had not then begun. I wish to get over this odious subject once for all as quickly as possible. These familiarities were rare, but they did occur spasmodically. They began about 9 months after I first met Oscar Wilde, as the result of a long, patient, and strenuous siege on his part. They were completely discontinued about 6 months before the final catastrophe, and were never resumed after he came out of prison. Wilde always claimed that his love for me was ideal and spiritual. I once, after he came out of prison, in the course of a somewhat acrimonious discussion, brought up against him that this was not strictly the case, and that there had been another side to it. He said, "Oh, it was so little that, and then only by accident. Essentially, it was always a reaching up towards the ideal, and in the end, it became utterly ideal." Honestly, I believe he thought this to be true and meant what he said. In any case, I am perfectly certain that his love for me, such as it really was before he went to prison, was the nearest he ever got to a pure and spiritual love. I have here, at great cost to myself, given a true account of our relations. Anyone is at liberty to believe me or not, but I wish to say solemnly that I have not tried to gloss them over, or make them appear less guilty than they were. Of the sin which takes its name from one of the cities of the plain, there never was the slightest question. I give this as my solemn word before God, as I hope to be saved. What there was quite bad enough. But, as I have already remarked, when all this happened I had been 6 years at school and at Oxford, and I had lost my moral sense, and had no religion. Years afterwards, when I became a Catholic, in the course of the general confession, which every convert has to make as a preliminary to being received into the church, I confessed all this, but I said then to the priest who heard my confession, Monsignor Bickerstaff Drew, "At the time when I did these things, I did not consider them wrong. If I had thought them wrong, I would not have done them." Even before I met Wilde, I had persuaded myself that sins of the flesh were not wrong, and my opinion was of course vastly strengthened and confirmed by his brilliantly reasoned defence of them, which may be said almost to have been the gospel of his life. He went through life preaching the gospel which he puts into the mouth of Lord Henry Wotton in Dorian Gray. Wilde was, in fact, a most powerful and convincing heresiarch. He preached that it was the duty of every man to live his own life to the utmost, to be always seeking for new sensations, and to have what he called the courage to commit what are called sins. I am trying to be fair to Wilde, and not to make him responsible for corrupting me more than he did. All the same, I must say that it strikes me now that the difference between us was this, that I was at that time a frank and natural pagan, and that he was a man who believed in sin, and yet deliberately committed it, thereby obtaining a doubly perverse pleasure. I was a boy, and he was a blasé and very intellectual and brilliant man who had immense experience of life. Inevitably, I assimilated his views to a great extent. In fact, I was so completely obsessed by them that they exercised over me the same kind of subconscious tyranny which the Darwinian theory of man's evolution from apes exercises over the minds of millions of men at this day. I really thought Wilde's arguments were unanswerable, just as otherwise reasonable people are hypnotized by the Darwinian theory, which, as a matter of fact, is only a theory, and likely to remain one. Long after Wilde was dead, and after I was married and had utterly got away from the Wilde cult and tradition, I went on subconsciously believing that he was, more or less, a prophet, and that his views about morals, whether one liked them or not, were based on abstract truth, and were unanswerable and irrefutable. It was not till after Wilde had been dead at least 8 years, and while, being then, of course, quite ignorant of the way he had turned and rent me in the unpublished part of De Profundis, I was still devoted to his memory, that it first occurred to me that he really was a very wicked man, quite apart from his sexual aberrations. I was then gradually getting towards a comprehension of the Christian system of ethics, which I had so long scorned. I passed through about 2 years of High Church Anglicanism while I was editing the Academy, and then, in 1911, I became a Catholic. It is a consideration of all these facts and abstractions which makes it impossible for me to pretend, as I would really like to be able to do, if only for the sake of obliging Mr. Frank Harris, that Wilde's friendship was ever any kind of a blessing to me, or that I owe him anything which I would not willingly part with, if I have not done so already. As I have already stated, it was certainly not he who taught me to love poetry or to write it. In the articles I wrote in my undergraduate magazine, The Spirit Lamp, and even in some of my first articles in the Academy, about 1907 to 1908, it is easy to trace a certain amount of his influence on my style and point of view. But I will defy anyone to find it in the stuff I wrote in prose in the last 2 years of my editorship of the Academy, or in that which I wrote in plain English, 1920 to 1921. While, as far as poetry, which is my long suit, is concerned, I can say without much fear of contradiction that, fortunately for me, he had no influence on me at all. His views on poetry, and on literature generally, were on the whole much sounder than one might suppose would be likely to be the case. He liked the best among dead authors, and was not above admitting that Dickens was a man of great genius, and he had a very fair critical faculty. On the whole, I would, even as I am now, have trusted him to pick out good new stuff when he saw it for the first time. He was quite capable of admiring the work of persons whom he personally disliked, a feat which appears to be beyond the compassing of a good many of our present-day critics. Henley, for example. And he always spoke generously about his contemporaries, provided, of course, that his artistic conscience, which was much more potent than his moral conscience, would permit him to do so. He greatly admired Pater, and he told me he would rather have written Swinburne's Poems and Ballads, first series, than anything that had appeared in the English language in his lifetime. He thought highly of Meredith, even more so of Tennyson, and he admired Frank Harris's short stories, Elder Conklin, and so forth, more than I have been able to do myself. He had at one time a considerable cult for Robert Louis Stevenson, and he was even sometimes enthusiastic about Kipling. His taste was sufficiently Catholic to include Anatole France, Paul Bourget, and Huysmans. He always professed to admire my poetry very much, though in the unpublished part of De Profundis, I am obliged to call it the unpublished part to differentiate it from the well-known book, though actually the unpublished part has been published broadcast in our own newspapers and in book form in America, Germany and France. He refers to it contemptuously as my undergraduate verse. However, as in the same intemperate outburst of spite and malice he makes slighting remarks about my personal appearance, and refers sneeringly to my low stature. I am 5 feet 9 inches, which, for a man of my originally very slight build and weight, 9 stone 7 in those days, was just about the right height. I do not take what he says very seriously. What I mean is that if he had worked himself up in De Profundis into the incredible state of mind in which he could run down the personal appearance of Hylas and Hyacinthus, not to insist on the rose of all the world, as he once called me in a letter, there can be no difficulty in supposing that his detraction of my poetry, which he had professed greatly to admire, was on the same level of sincerity or insincerity. To sum up what I want to convey, I mean that while he certainly did not corrupt my taste in literature, or do me any harm from a literary point of view, I am not conscious of being under any debt to him in that direction, while on the moral side he did exercise a most frightful influence on me, which it took me many years to outgrow. How then can I pretend to feel gratitude to him for what he did? All I can truly say is that I was at one time absolutely devoted to him, as he undoubtedly was to me, and that in those days my greatest pleasure was to be with him. He had delightful gifts as a talker and as a friend. He was, before prison had smashed him and demoralized him, most kind and hospitable, and generally sweet-tempered. The appalling bad taste of his references in the unpublished part of De Profundis to the money he spent on entertaining the darling of his heart and soul would have been utterly impossible to the old Oscar Wilde as I first knew him, even if his always exuberant imagination had been equal to the task of inflating that sum into the good round one of £5,000, which is the figure he arrived at in jail, apparently by the simple process of adding together nearly all the money he had during all the time that he had known me, and lumping it together as the amount he had spent on me. I have expressed in one of the sonnets I wrote about him after he was dead, the dead poet, the magical quality of his conversation. And as of old, in music measureless, I heard his golden voice, and marked him trace under the common thing the hidden grace, and conjure wonder out of emptiness, till mean things put on beauty like a dress, and all the world was an enchanted place. He did succeed in weaving spells. One sat and listened to him enthralled. It all appeared to be wisdom and power and beauty and enchantment. It was indeed enchantment and nothing else. But a man who has broken loose from a spell cannot look back on the enchantment again and recapture the illusion of the shattered spell. He can only, as I do, remember that it was so, and wonder, and perhaps shudder a little. End of chapter 12.